today on the Undivided Podcast. My interview with the Democratic Congresswoman about abortion caused a little stir online.
I don't think that Justice Thomas would rule against something that he's actively engaged in, do you? Let's be realistic.
Oh, it wouldn't surprise me.
Would the U.S. Supreme Court truly reverse precedent on interracial marriage? We're going to do a deep dive on that topic. Plus, the pledge that Joe Biden made when he was a presidential candidate that he seems to have already forgotten. And finally, I moderated a panel over the weekend on the state of the media. I'll share some interesting insights.
The problem for a lot of local media is that they rely on the access to the governor.
Thank you to the founding sponsor of Undivided, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com. Welcome to the Undivided Podcast on this Monday. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you so much for listening. If you're here, that means you are dedicated to giving common sense a comeback, and I love it. Wow, did we cause a little bit of a stir with my interview? It went up for subscribers Sunday on the Undivided Digital Show. The interview with Congresswoman Marilyn Strickland, a Democrat from Washington's 10th Congressional District. The topic of the interview, the broader topic of the interview, was abortion and the likely repeal of Roe.
I think sometimes the argument is very black and white, but when someone has to make this horrible decision, there are so many nuances that go into making these very tough decisions.
But what caused a stir is within that conversation, the Congresswoman and I, if you listen to the podcast, I played a clip of this on Friday, the Congresswoman segued into, as many Democrats have done since the leak of the Supreme Court document around Roe, segued into what kind of precedent could come next if the high court overturns Roe v. Wade. There have been concerns expressed by Democrats about gay marriage, and even further than that, about interracial marriage. Here's that part of the conversation. You know, the idea of the Supreme Court rolling back like interracial marriage to me sounds like fear-mongering.
No, well, you know, maybe, you know, in your life experience, that's something that doesn't seem real to you. When my parents came to the United States and my mom and dad came from Korea, it was illegal for them to be married in my lifetime. In 1964. And if you talk to some people, there are people in this country in some states who still are against interracial marriage. And even think about the whole conversation about interracial relationships and some of the things that have happened, you know, the whole idea of some of these young Black men who were back in the day accused of looking at a white woman the wrong way, and all of a sudden he ends up lynched or hurt. And so, again, we think these things seem so out of you think to yourself, this wouldn't happen this day and age, but you just never know what people believe and what they're willing to do.
Well, there are racist, crazy people in this country. I mean, just look at Buffalo, New York, but Justice Thomas is married to a white woman.
Yes, and Justice Thomas often votes and rules on things that are against his own interests.
So, you know. I don't think that Justice Thomas would rule against something that he's actively engaged in, do you? Let's be realistic.
Oh, it wouldn't surprise me.
Really, it would not surprise you if Justice Clarence Thomas voted to repeal the rights of interracial couples to be married.
Or he could say that moving forward, they're against the law. Absolutely.
And it really wouldn't surprise you, Congresswoman, to solidify his own and to take it away from people moving forward, interracial marriage?
Clarence Thomas is an African-American man who voted against voting rights, the very rights that people have fought for. I mean, he is a beneficiary of people fighting and dying to have the right to vote and to participate in democracy. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's disappointing. But at the same time, you know, it's just hard to say what people are capable of these days. And I remind folks that Loving v. Virginia was not that long ago. And there are people who have gone on record saying that they're against interracial marriage.
So that clip got shared quite a bit on social media with folks essentially arguing what I'm arguing, which is that is a pretty extreme view of what could follow if Roe v. Wade is repealed. And it almost seems like this is a Democratic talking point that has been put out. I mean, it has to be, because you hear so many Democrats and Democratic talking heads who are echoing those same sentiments, trying to scare Americans into thinking that gay marriage is next, that interracial marriage is next. And so I really do believe this is one of those things that, like, Nancy Pelosi or someone has sent down to the troops saying, these are the points that we need to be making that we think are going to get through to Americans. So I wanted to take a minute to dissect a little bit of that conversation with Congresswoman Marilyn Strickland. And again, you can watch the full interview. It's up right now for subscribers at patreon.com/undivided or on my locals community, brandicruz.locals.com. I have sent the Congresswoman's office a couple follow-ups. We were a little short on time during the interview. And one of the things she said there at the end,
it's just hard to say what people are capable of these days. And I remind folks that Loving v. Virginia was not that long ago. And there are people who have gone on record saying that they're against interracial marriage.
I followed up with her office to ask, okay, who is on the record as being opposed to interracial marriage? I'm sure there are some racist, crazy people in America who are on the record on maybe social media saying they oppose interracial marriage, but who has stated on the record they're opposed to it that would make any difference at all in terms of it actually being repealed? So I've asked the Congresswoman that, you know, who is she referring to there?
And there are people who have gone on record saying that they're against interracial marriage.
Now, there are some, like I said, crazies who've said that over the years. You guys might recall that Michigan candidate back in 2019. Does this ring any bells to you?
When you have a white woman and a black husband, a white wife and a black husband together, that's wrong, and vice versa.
Now, that was a woman who was like a city council candidate in a city in Michigan. So yeah, her view is absolutely abhorrent, but she's not in a position to actually influence any policy around interracial marriage in this country. Now, there has been at least one more recent and more high-profile comment on interracial marriage that I can see as a bit more disturbing than that one in terms of its actual weight. Back at the end of March of this year, Republican Senator Mike Braun of Indiana was talking about this issue of, you know, the Supreme Court ruling on things that perhaps should be left up to the states. And he was asked whether he believes interracial marriage is one of those things. And again, this is just 2 months ago.
So you would be okay with the Supreme Court leaving the question of interracial marriage to the states?
Yes, I think that that's something that if you're not wanting the Supreme Court to weigh in on issues like that, you're not going to be able to have your cake and eat it too. I think that's hypocritical.
So I don't hear him. I'm going to keep playing his answer in a second, but up to there, he's not saying he is opposed to interracial marriage. He's saying it's an issue that should be left to the states. Now, I think that's stupid and doesn't make any sense, and I'll explain why legally speaking in a second. He goes on from there.
Well, you can list a whole host of issues. When it comes down to whatever they are, I'm going to say that they're not going to all make you happy within a given state, but that we're better off having states manifest their points of view rather than homogenizing it across the country as Roe versus Wade did.
To suggest that states or the country would be better off if you didn't have a homogenized law about interracial marriage, and for a sitting United States senator to say that in 2022 is just idiotic. And it's also not an apples-to-apples comparison about the argument to kick abortion back to the states. So I want to do just a quick refresher here on interracial marriage and Loving v. Virginia, which was the case in 1967. That was the landmark ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court that said, no, you can't have laws that ban interracial marriage or make interracial marriage illegal. The case centered around a couple, Mildred Loving, she was black, and her husband, Richard Loving, was white. And they were, of course, living in Virginia, and they both were sentenced to a year in prison for getting married. In Virginia at the time, there was a law called Virginia's Racial Integrity Act of 1924. And it basically said that white people couldn't marry, quote, colored people. Now, the state of Virginia at the time had argued that this didn't violate the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution because they said that it didn't lead to different outcomes for people on the basis of race, because whether you were the white person in the relationship or the black person in the relationship, you were both convicted. It wasn't like the black person would be convicted for marrying a white person and the white person would just be off scot-free. So that was their argument. They're saying, no, it doesn't lead to unequal treatment under the law because they both get in trouble regardless of the color of their skin. Well, the Supreme Court, on a unanimous basis, so a 9-0 decision in 1967, ruled that in fact the Racial Integrity Act in Virginia did violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So a refresher on the Equal Protection Clause. It reads that no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. In its decision, the Supreme Court ruled that the Virginia law did just that, saying that the law rests, quote, solely upon distinctions drawn according to race. What the court found is that you have an institution like marriage that is generally accepted conduct, right? Marriage is generally accepted to be legal. And you have a law that takes generally accepted conduct and treats it differently on the basis of the race of people engaging in that conduct. So that was the basis of the Supreme Court's ruling in Loving v. Virginia. How that's different than Roe v. Wade is that abortion was not, in the early days of America, considered generally accepted conduct. And so it wasn't inherently enshrined in the Constitution. So folks that believe that the issue of abortion is absolutely something the Supreme Court should be ruling on, they also point to the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. And while it's true that that particular provision has been applied to some rights that weren't explicitly mentioned in the Constitution, it's only done so when you have a right that is, quote, deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition and implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. Stay with me here. So when you consider what rights are deeply rooted in the nation's history and tradition, is marriage one of those things? Of course. Is abortion one of those things? No. In fact, when the 14th Amendment was adopted, 75% of states had laws outlawing abortion. Even Washington state, which is now one of the most progressive states in the country. It wasn't until 1970 that abortion was legal in Washington state. Before that, you could not have an abortion unless the life of the mother was at risk. It was basically banned entirely. And people have to remember, the U.S. Supreme Court is bound by the Constitution. That's what they're judging cases based off of, is the constitutionality. Now, there is some wiggle room when you get into an individual justice's interpretation of the Constitution and what it protects. That's why the decision, when it eventually comes out on Roe v. Wade, is going to be split. But again, in Loving v. Virginia, back in 1967, all of the Supreme Court justices ruled unanimously that marriage is absolutely something that is protected by the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, and that having different rules around marriage based on the race of those engaging with it is unconstitutional. So if you're looking at what Senator Mike Braun from Indiana said back in March.
So you would be okay with the Supreme Court leaving the question of interracial marriage to the states?
Yes, I think that that's something that if you're not wanting the Supreme Court to weigh in on issues like that, you're not going to be able to have your cake and eat it too. I think that's hypocritical.
It just tells me he's not fully grasping the differences between abortion and marriage and what the Supreme Court can and should be weighing in on. But I didn't take his clip to suggest that he's against interracial marriage. He just has a very faulty interpretation of who should be in charge of making those decisions. One other part of the Marilyn Strickland interview I want to break down for you. We had a conversation about what issues Americans are prioritizing, and obviously inflation came up, and I brought up to her my frustration with how the president has handled this issue. Biden in the last few days has blamed inflation on everyone under the sun, the Republicans, right. Trump, rich people, meat producers, Putin, right. Putinflation. And honestly, as an American, I'm like, just fix it. I don't care. Be laser focused on fixing it because you signed up for this job. You asked for this job. And so it's off-putting to me when the president is more focused on pushing blame on that issue than being focused like a laser on addressing it and bringing costs down for Americans. Do you believe the president has been particularly good at dealing with this issue for the American people?
Well, when it comes to the bare knuckle politics of how things work, you know, when people blame you for something, then you actually push back. And so for me, it's like, okay, I mean, I agree with you, Brandy. Let's work together. Let's come up with solutions and say, how do we work with the American people? But when you have one party putting blame on the president, he's going to have to push back. And here's the irony in all this. It's like, you know, people are blaming President Biden from the other party, but they're offering no solutions, not a thing. And so as someone who has been a mayor, who's had to work to solve problems, regardless of what your political affiliation is, I mean, let's just sit down and say, here's the problem. What is the outcome we want? How do we get there together? I mean, you know that. This is what people want in this country.
I would love to see that. I would love to see that. I mean, just totally coming together to fix problems. But I can't help but think that if we had $5 or 10 cent gas prices under Trump, that Democrats would be doing the exact same damn thing.
Yeah, you know, I can't tell you that's not true. And again, there's a tendency to blame the person who's in charge and say it's all your fault.
And that brings me to a point where I want to just reiterate my thoughts on President Biden, the issue of inflation and gas prices. I have said repeatedly on this podcast that I do not blame President Joe Biden individually for inflation and for gas prices. I have said repeatedly on this podcast that those are complex issues that are driven by a variety of factors. Yes, including Putin and his invasion of Ukraine. Yes, including the pandemic. My only issue I have taken with President Biden's handling of gas prices, inflation, etc., is that he should be more focused on dealing with the issue rather than playing the blame game. As I've noted, President Biden has been spending an awful lot of time, or probably his staff, on Twitter, and during press conferences for that matter, blaming everyone under the sun for these problems. Lately, a favorite target has been just Republicans broadly, and that's because we're in a midterm election. Joe Biden, May 22nd, Republicans don't want to solve inflation by lowering costs. They want to solve it by raising taxes and lowering your income. And as I pointed out to Congresswoman Strickland, he's blamed Putin, he's blamed oil producers, he's blamed meat producers, he's blamed Donald Trump, he's blamed rich people. And you might say, well, Brandy, you're admitting that the president isn't solely to blame for these issues. Why should he have to take responsibility for them? Because the president promised he would. Because the president himself, when he was running for office, when he was trying to get our votes, promised that he would take responsibility for them. That's why. The president's own tweet leading up to the 2020 election, August 16th, 2020. Here's my promise to you. If I'm elected president, I will always choose to unite rather than divide. I'll take responsibility instead of blaming others. I'll never forget that the job isn't about me, it's about you. Let's break that down. Here's my promise to you. If I'm elected president, I will always choose to unite rather than divide. Well, Mr. President, how is that going? Let me read a tweet from the president 3 hours ago. The ultra-mega Republicans' proposal puts Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid on the chopping block every 5 years. The ultra-mega Republicans. This is a plan from Senator Rick Scott that would call for Congress to basically reaffirm, re-vote on legislation and laws every 5 years. And even Fox News pointed out, this is Dana Perino, even Fox News pointed out, well, that's kind of just Rick Scott's plan and nobody likes it.
Just because he comes out and says ultra MAGA 20 times is not going to make inflation go away. They can also say Rick Scott 100,000 times. That guy is eating alone at the lunch table. Basically, there's nobody in the Republican Party that signed on to his plan. He can have his plan and he has every right to try to push it. But by no means does the ultra MAGA group actually support it. That's absurd.
We've got the president jumping on that, saying the ultra mega Republicans proposal puts Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid on the chopping block every 5 years. Mr. President, how is that working into your promise to Americans on the campaign trail to, quote, always choose to unite rather than divide? Let's move on to the second line in your tweet. I'll take responsibility instead of blaming others. I'll take responsibility instead of blaming others. Well, that's a nice sentiment, but how about on May 13th when you blamed rich people? Writing on Twitter, you want to bring down inflation? Let's make sure the wealthiest corporations pay their fair share. How about on May 11th when you put the blame squarely on Putin? Who again, I believe, shares some of the blame, but I thought as the president, you were going to take responsibility. He wrote, tune in as I deliver remarks on Putin's price hike. What happened on May 10th when you blamed Republicans? Writing, I happen to think it's a good thing when American families have more money in their pockets at the end of the month, but Republicans in Congress don't seem to think so. Their plan is going to make working families poorer. What about on May 14th when you blamed Donald Trump? Under my predecessor, the deficit increased every single year. This year, we're on track to cut the deficit by $1.5 trillion, the biggest one-year decline ever. It matters to families because reducing the deficit is one of the main ways we can ease inflationary pressures. What about May 11th, Mr. President, when you blamed meat producers? Only four big companies control more than half the meat market, and they can use their position to overcharge. It was Joe Biden himself who pledged to Americans that he would be a different president than Donald Trump. Donald Trump was not one to take blame for anything. I've said many times, I didn't vote for Donald Trump. I don't think Donald Trump was fit for the White House. I don't want Donald Trump to run again. But Joe Biden convinced Americans in 2020 that he was perhaps not a better politician, but a better human being, and that he would take responsibility for things in a way that Donald Trump didn't. He would take blame for things. He would be a leader. But he's not delivering on the promises that he made as a candidate. He's not behaving as a president in the way he promised he would behave. That is the issue that I'm taking. There's folks on Twitter all wound up because they think I'm blaming individually Joe Biden alone, himself, on an island for inflation and gas prices, rather than seeing it as the incredibly nuanced issue that it is. No, I'm saying that he's not acting like the leader he promised he would act like. I also think it's incredibly entertaining that you have Democrats on Twitter who are eager, jumping at the chance to defend Biden, saying, oh, the gas prices aren't his fault, and to offer these really nuanced explanations. Well, actually, Brandy, it's all these competing markets and all this. It's like, that's fine. I'm appreciating your nuanced response and approach to what's causing inflation. But the point I'm making is you never would have given the benefit of the doubt to Donald Trump. Can you imagine if gas prices were $5.50 a gallon under Donald Trump, what Democrats would be saying? They would not be saying, oh, well, there's a variety of factors that are contributing to gasoline being at this level. No, they would probably be calling for Donald Trump to resign. And even Marilyn Strickland, when I asked her that question or pointed that out to her, had to acknowledge, well, you're probably right.
But I can't help but think that if we had $5 or 10 cent gas prices under Trump, that Democrats would be doing the exact same damn thing.
Yeah, you know, I can't tell you that's not true. And again, there's a tendency to blame the person who's in charge and say, it's all your fault.
So what this all boils down to is something it often boils down to, which is having a consistent moral compass, which is judging actions before affiliation, and expecting leaders to lead. And part of being a good leader is taking responsibility, not assigning blame. Something candidate Joe Biden promised us he would do. One more topic I want to fit in, but first I want to talk about cash out refis with my friends at 1530 Mortgage, the founding sponsor of Undivided. Mortgages are rough right now. Rates are going through the roof. And so you're not seeing as many people try to get new home mortgages as we had been seeing for some time. However, there is still a pretty high need for cash out refis. There are folks who need access to cash for a variety of reasons, and they have equity in their homes. Now, I've said over and over, cash out refi isn't for everyone, but it might just be what you're looking for right now. Here is Rich Hunt, the founder of 1530 Mortgage.
We have a lot of veterans, for instance, of our armed forces who I know watch Undivided. Is there any special thing they should know about doing a cash out refi?
Well, absolutely. If you have VA entitlements or you're enlisted or retired service member, yeah, VA cash loan is one of the best benefits you can have. You can go to 100% equity position in the home and have a fantastic rate.
So if you're in need of cash, you've got some equity in your home, maybe you're not sure, is a cash out refi right for me? Call my friends at 1530 Mortgage and just ask them some questions. They're really nice guys over there. I just was over there the other day chatting with them, and they'll pick up the phone and help you through it and give you some good advice. 1530mortgage.com or call them at 206-207-7777. 1530 Mortgage, NMLS ID 1761573, equal housing opportunity. For informational purposes only, not an offer to extend credit. Credit approval required. Information and or dates are subject to change without notice. Not available in all states. Certain programs may not be eligible. Other restrictions may apply. I spoke at the Mainstream Republicans Cascade Conference over the weekend over in Leavenworth, Washington. This is a group of Republicans in Washington state that are really center right and trying to find out how they can take back Washington state. They see a lot of opportunity this year for that. And I see, frankly, a lot of opportunity for them as well. We've talked about on the podcast that polls, there's been various polls, but say like 75 to 79% of Americans aren't happy with the direction of the country. Whenever you have that, you're going to have more voters looking to the party that's not in power. And so you have these moderate Republicans who see an opportunity to get independents and even moderate Democrats on board. And I not only gave a keynote address to them this weekend about the current political climate, but I also participated in a panel on the state of the media. And I thought it would be interesting to play part of that for you. I moderated the panel. The panelists were my friend Jason Rantz, frequent guest on Fox News, a conservative radio host in Seattle, host of the Jason Rantz Show on 770 KTTH. Contrast that with a more mainstream member of the media, Jerry Kornfield. He has been the State House reporter for the Daily Herald in Everett, Washington since 2004. And also joining us was Paul Query. Now, Paul has an interesting background. He was a veteran Associated Press reporter, so about as mainstream as it gets. And then he went on to go independent. He founded the Washington Observer, which is an independent newsletter on politics. There were a couple of clips from this that I thought would be particularly interesting. One of the things I've noticed with Jason Rantz, so Jason is conservative. He is on Fox. He admits he's conservative. He has a slant, and that's what kind of media he brings to the table. But Jason, I will say, does some really interesting stories that have, I believe, news value for any outlet, that are obvious news stories. And there was one I saw. He did a story on a school board director who also happens to own a sex shop. Yeah, sex shop with toys and sex books and all this stuff. She decided to host an LGBTQ youth open mic night event for kids 0 to 18 at her sex shop. Okay. School board director inviting kids to her sex shop, like where there's dildos and things. Sorry for being crass. I'm just trying to paint a picture for you. To me, that's an obvious news story. Like, you don't invite kids to a sex shop. Why? That we should all agree that is pretty egregious. Well, one of the questions I asked Jason Rantz at this panel is why he believes that when he does, and he does stories like that all the time, why those types of stories don't get touched by the mainstream media.
Nobody else in the mainstream media picks it up. Why do you think that is?
So I think there's two issues at play. Number one, if any conservative personality breaks a story, there is a reluctance from, generally speaking, these are leftist reporters, and they don't want to touch that because they think by touching that, they are endorsing a conservative opinion. But I look at some of these stories, this one included, it's not really a conservative opinion. I think most reasonable people can say probably shouldn't have a youth open mic at a sex shop. I don't think that that is a left versus right issue. It can be framed that way, including by me. Of course, I will frame it in certain ways, especially for the radio show. But number two, I think that there are folks on the left in media who agree with a lot of what's going on. I think the reason why, just looking at sort of the life cycle of some of the CRT stories, critical race theory, you've got folks who agree with it, who work in media, so they don't want to criticize. So first they'll pretend it's not really happening, and they'll play into some of the talking points that you're getting from some Democrat politicians. And then when it becomes too much to pretend it doesn't exist, then you start to see the spin. And you're talking, for a lot of these folks, especially in Seattle media, they're talking in an echo chamber. They're not talking to a lot of you guys. They're not talking to Snohomish County or Pierce County. They're talking to Seattle. And they're not even really talking to King County as a whole. They're talking to Seattle. That's where they live. That's where they work. That's where all their friends are, where they hang out. And so they don't want to disrupt any of that. And I think that that has been a huge part of the problem with media. Just tell us the story. You can give us both sides. And you can easily find both sides, especially in Seattle, on all of these stories. And I think we would all be better consumers of news, better prepared to have some of these conversations if outlets did that.
Another part of the conversation I thought was interesting, we had a conversation about access and whether you have journalists who hold back a little bit on politicians who they're regularly needing to ask questions to or do interviews with for fear that their access to that particular politician might be cut off. For instance, if you're Jerry Kornfield, I'm just using him as an example because he was at the panel, and you are covering the State House, that's your beat. Do you go a little easy on politicians who you know that you're going to have to rely on for information and for interviews every single day? So this is an issue we were debating during the panel.
Part of the problem, whether you're dealing with Jay Inslee or anyone who's in the governor's, hopefully soon a Republican, the problem for a lot of local media is that they rely on the access to the governor. And thus, they're not, I don't think, willing to push as hard in some cases, not all cases, But I think they hold back. I think you still run into the problem of them generally agreeing with the governor, but they can't piss him off, because if they do, then they don't end up getting future interviews. They fear losing that kind of access and not being able to do their jobs. I think local media is put in a very difficult position. I do also think that they could do a lot better in pushing back at some of the talking points. But we heard it during this media availability, where he makes the point of not wanting to put a pause to the gas tax, because that means that the oil companies are just going to jack up their rates at the pump. That's not how it works. That's not at all ever how it worked. And we didn't really get any pushback to that. Because again, I think that there were reporters in the room who were like, yeah, I don't really want to get rid of the gas tax either because of environmental issues that might all be completely valid.
But could it also be because they didn't understand the issue?
It's certainly possible, but if you're going to ask the question, you better know the issue so that you can, in fact, do a follow-up.
Yeah. All thoughts?
So, I mean, one of the great pleasures of the way that I run the Observer is that I don't actually care whether the governor takes my questions or not, but I'm a close observer of the news conferences, and I will say that the format during the pandemic and even now is to shut down that kind of free-flowing inquiry that the press corps is supposed to have in those circumstances, in my money, which is to say that if the governor ducks Jerry's question, you know, the next person down the road might ask his or her question and then say, Governor, you also didn't answer Jerry's question, so mm-hmm. could you answer it? And I think that his strategy, and as someone who spent a decade advising people on communication strategy, I can't really argue with the strategy, is to exercise a lot of control.
I mean, I think if you go, and we're going to use the current chief executive, I mean, third term governor, if you trace his whole time in office, I think now he's figured it out how to keep the lid on conversations. I mean, I found it interesting that he left town Thursday. He's out of town for a couple of days, private time. And it's when he's out of state, we get the press release that he is going to cancel the parole for a convicted murderer. And then we get the press release that he's ending a portion of one of the vax mandates he has. And so there's absolutely, and this all happens less than 24 hours after a press conference. So obviously those were questions that came up at the press conference, and the answers we got were totally different than the actions that followed. And so that's, to Paul's point, I mean, he's really masterful in that regard, he and his folks, on controlling message and limiting his access. And I, for one, don't mind I'm not fearful if he takes my question or not, or gives me an interview, because a lot of times you just don't have a follow-up, right? You don't have an effective follow-up with some folks, and he's maybe one that will elicit an answer. So that's...
Yeah, and there's times where you'll do a follow-up, and I teased the interview airing on my podcast on Sunday with Congresswoman Marilyn Strickland. I had asked four times what her stance on abortion was, what her specific stance was, and so there's sometimes, as a journalist, where you're like, I have 10 minutes with this person. How much of that interview am I going to spend asking the same question? And so you make a decision, do I move on? And sometimes it's hard to do.
Well, sometimes you just got to be rude, and you got to just step in and say, I hear you, but you're not answering my question directly.
Yeah.
And it's always, again, it's kind of a weird position for a lot of reporters who are in positions where they require access. You don't require access. I don't require access at all. You don't have to have access. It makes your job a lot easier. But we don't have to have access to the governor. I could care less if he ever comes on my radio show, because I don't need to talk to him to get to stories.
Jerry, do you take it soft on the governor to get access?
I'm trying to think if I've had a one-on-one interview with the governor in the last 6 years, so I'm not sure. No, I don't go soft. I mean, there are times when you just don't have anything to ask, but you go to be in the room, and I think this is one of those weeks.
I really love conversations like that, just because they can be illuminating for how the media works, and I thought this was a great panel because it did have someone who, you know, had a conservative bias, someone who was more mainstream, someone who had done independent news but also did mainstream media. So I'm actually going to post the video from that entire panel up on my Patreon and my Locals pages, patreon.com/undivided and brandycruz.locals.com, and they will not be behind a paywall, so you can go there and watch it even if you are not a subscriber. That's it for this episode of the Undivided Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I will talk to all of you again on Friday. Thank you to the founding sponsor of Undivided, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com.